You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The UN Security Council is set to vote on another round of sanctions against Iran for its nuclear program, and Turkey's relationship with the United States has worsened lately due to tension over Iran and Israel. But in his latest book, Reset: Iran, Turkey, and America's Future, Stephen Kinzer argues that the U.S. should work to forge new partnerships with those countries to help stabilize the Middle East and surrounding regions. He also calls for overhauling America's relationship with its two current primary allies in the Middle East, Israel and Saudi Arabia. Stephen Kinzer was an award-winning foreign correspondent for The New York Times, has written several books. He now teaches international relations at Boston University and writes a column for The Guardian in the UK. His book is published by Times Books, and I'm very pleased it has brought him back to our show today. Hello.
Great to be with you.
Now, Iran is currently branded as a rogue state, an enemy of the United States that supports terrorism. Why would Washington want to partner with it?
Exactly for that reason. You don't need to negotiate with your friends. They already agree with you. The ones you need to negotiate with are the countries that cause you trouble, the countries that you don't like and the countries that don't like you.
But it has been pointed out that Iran shares any number of strategic goals with the United States, despite the fact that we seem to be avowed enemies.
This is a remarkable fact that I don't think too many people focus on. When America or any country is looking for partners in the world, I think you're looking for partners that have two criteria. Number one, you want countries that share your long-term strategic goals. And number two, you want countries whose societies are something like your society. Saudi Arabia, for example, doesn't qualify on either score. But when you talk about, as you did, the strategic congruence between America's long-term interests and Iran's long-term interests, and you leave your emotion out of the room, you can see coolly that it's in our interest to have a better relationship with Iran. Iran has great ability to help stabilize Iraq. In fact, Iran can probably do more to stabilize Iraq than any country in the world, including the U.S. They could be our ticket out of Iraq.
Some people have pointed out that the winner in the war with Iraq has been Iran, not the United States.
By overthrowing Saddam Hussein, we essentially turned over that whole country to Iran. And now we have to deal with the results of that now. Iran also has great ability to stabilize Afghanistan. A large part of Afghanistan used to be part of Iran. They speak the same language. Iran has deep ties there. Iran is the bitter enemy of radical Sunni movements like al-Qaeda and the Taliban, who want to kill all Shiites. So in the long run, Iran not only has these strategic interests in common with us, but its society, not its government, but its society is highly democratic. It's been 100 years thinking about democracy. So it's a very intriguing place. I've just come back from there, and I saw again the pro-American sentiment and the democratic effervescence of ordinary people.
Well, it was once a democracy, but the United States helped overthrow Mossadegh and reinstated the Shah, and that was a repressive regime replaced by another kind of repressive regime. So it's been a long time. What was it, 1954?
1953, exactly. Mohammad Mossadegh was here in New York speaking at the United Nations in 1951. It was exactly his nationalization of oil that led to his overthrow. That wasn't just the overthrow of one guy. That was the end of democracy in Iran. Now, there are about three paradigms for possible governments in Iran. There's a secular democracy, there's military rule, and there's religious rule. Well, as you said, the democratic period was brought to a violent end in 1953. Then we had 25 years of the Shah, military rule. Then a period of religious rule. If the cycle holds true and Iranians finally are able to express themselves, democracy should be next in line.
You point out that a man named Howard Baskerville is still remembered fondly by the Iranians. But don't they also resent the fact that we toppled Mossadegh?
The pro-American sentiment in Iran is truly remarkable. There is no other Muslim country in the world and no country in the Middle East where most people are pro-American, only Iran. And I saw that over and over in my trip there last month. People just shriek when they find out you're from America and you immediately draw a crowd and everybody's so positive. It's true. You ask yourself, since we were the ones who overthrew Iranian democracy and set them on this path to all this tragedy they've gone through these recent decades, why would they feel that way? I think there is a genuine admiration for what the United States has accomplished and an envy. I mean, after all, we threw the British out and became an independent country. That's what the Iranians see themselves as having done.
You're not talking about Ahmadinejad or the leadership. You're talking about the general public?
Yes. And the stories I tell in my book are intended in part to show this long relationship between the U.S. and Iran as Iran developed its democracy. The story of Howard Baskerville, which I start my book with, is one that has been completely lost to history. I love the fact that I'm trying to rescue this person from oblivion. This was a 24-year-old schoolteacher from Nebraska who went to Tabriz in northern Iran as a missionary schoolteacher in 1908. Got very involved in the democratic movement and was involved in battles and was actually killed while fighting for democracy in Iran. So this was really the beginning of the blood connection between the United States and Iran's struggle for democracy.
You compare Iran today to Germany after World War II. Why?
When you look at a map of the Middle East, one thing jumps out at you. Iran is the big country right in the middle. When you look at a map of Europe, that's the way Germany looks. After World War II, there was naturally tremendous anti-German emotion and a lot of desire to punish Germany. At the beginning, this was the U.S. policy. We adopted what was called the Morgenthau Plan, where Germany would be dismembered. It was not going to be allowed ever to have a factory again. It was just going to be an agrarian country. But cooler heads prevailed, and the idea became the Marshall Plan. Let's encourage Germany to join the family. That's what I think we need in the Middle East with Iran.
But attempts have been made on both sides. The United States has sent out all sorts of feelers. When Barack Obama was running for president, he sure talked about sitting down with the Iranian leadership and working things out. After 9/11, Iran seemed to be amenable to doing things with the United States. But the people on both sides have sabotaged them. So obviously, it's a lot more difficult than just simply saying, hey, let's look at what happened when Nixon went to China and everything will be great.
It's a very complex situation. You're right. And there are factions on both sides that have an interest and a desire to upset this, to make sure that this reconciliation doesn't happen. But nonetheless, I would like to see the United States make an appeal, an approach to Iran that we haven't done up to now. And that is to say, we don't insist on negotiating just on the nuclear issue. That's the issue that we're interested in. But we know that you also have your issues you'd like to negotiate on. So we're willing to open broad negotiations. You bring everything to the table you don't like about us, and we'll bring all our complaints about you. If we do that, rather than try to limit negotiations only to the nuclear issue, there might be the possibility of some progress.
How serious is the Iranian nuclear threat?
I take it very seriously. I find it very disturbing. I think the fact that Iran is conducting its program partly in obscurity and out of the eye of the world, and the fact that Iran at the same time is developing new ballistic missiles is hugely destabilizing. I'd like to see anything done to prevent this project from resulting in a nuclear-armed Iran. The question is, how do we get there? Our policy of not talking to Iran, which we adopted in 2003 when we rejected the offer to which you just referred, has not led us anywhere. Since we rejected that offer, the number of centrifuges in Iran has increased almost tenfold. So it's not working not to talk to them. The situation is getting more acute. This is not a frozen conflict like Nagorno-Karabakh or Cyprus where you can just sit back and say, well, I'd like to get it solved, but if it doesn't get solved, no big deal. This problem is getting worse every day.
But Iran really must be feeling more and more isolated. Even China now is going along with the new sanctions.
China, of course, insisted that the sanctions be watered down quite a bit before they went along. But it is true that Iran, in one sense, shares a dilemma with Israel. These are the two countries in the Middle East that a lot of their neighbors don't like and trust, and they're also the two countries that a lot of countries in the world don't like. There is a tremendous amount of anti-Iranian emotion and anti-Israeli emotion coursing around the world right now. There's a great desire to punish one or both of these countries. I think this is a big mistake. It's not a good idea to punish and sanction and denounce Israel or Iran and push them into a corner and make them feel like they have no friends. It's better to try to draw them out in a way that might entice both of them to join some kind of a regional security architecture in which they could begin to feel safe.
Well, what could the United States, what steps could it take to promote the democratic opposition movement in Iran without looking like it's trying to interfere with Iran's internal politics?
Very little. And I tell you, I was, as I said, just in Iran, and I had a chance to talk to many, many ordinary people. And this was the main question I asked. So what happened to your opposition movement? We read about all these marches after the election last year, but we haven't seen anything lately. What happened? And the answer I got over and over again was, we tried that. It didn't work. They beat us, and they put us in jail. If we do it again, they'll beat us more and put us in jail more. There will be change here, but it's not going to come soon. In a country with 25 centuries of history, which is 10 times more than the United States, that attitude, take your time, let's be patient, things will happen, is very understandable. But it's different from the American attitude. We are very impatient. We want a result right away, and we're not going to get that in Iran.
My guest is Stephen Kinzer. His latest book, Reset, Iran, Turkey, and America's Future. So let's talk about Turkey for a moment. Unlike Iran, Turkey has been an American ally, although the relationship has been rather strained lately due to tensions over Iran and over Israel. How would you characterize the current state of the alliance?
There's certainly some friction now between the U.S. and Turkey, and it's, as you say, quite unaccustomed because these are two countries that are NATO allies and have worked very closely together for many years. I think this friction is not just a result of the attempt that Turkey made to broker a deal with Iran on the nuclear issue, which America did not like, nor is it just a response to the Gaza episode in which the ship that was boarded by the Israeli commandos was, of course, manned mostly by Turks, and Turks were those who were killed. I think there's a bigger psychological or geopolitical disconnect that is at the bottom of this breach, and it's this. Turkey is telling the United States, your approach to the Middle East is too confrontational. You need to ratchet down your policies and think more about conciliation and compromise and negotiation. We're here in the neighborhood. We suffer when there's havoc, and we don't want to be left holding the bag. But the Americans are not prepared yet to say, maybe we don't know what's the best way to approach the Middle East. Let's ask somebody else.
Well, don't they blame us when things go wrong? Weren't the demonstrations after the flotilla incident against the United States?
There was an element of that, and certainly American support for Israel during these last months has become even more controversial in Turkey than it ever has before for this reason. I don't think you're seeing in Turkey a sort of a growing anti-Israel or Islamist policy, but you are seeing a reaction specifically to the Gaza episode. You got to put yourself in the place of these Turks and other people in the Middle East who are watching every day on their TV, seeing what's happening in Gaza. Episodes are replayed time and time again. Gaza was behind this blow-up that Prime Minister Erdogan had at Davos with the Israeli president. So the Gaza thing is what has really set this the Turkish emotions on edge.
Well, there's been a change in Turkish politics for many years. It was totally secular, and that was one of the reasons why that Turkey and Israel could establish close ties. I understand Turkey is the favorite vacation spot for many Israelis. But that's all changed now that there is a religious party in power. There seem to be factions that want closer ties with the West and factions that definitely don't and would like to see a lot more Islamicization of the country.
There's been a lot of talk about the Islamization of Turkish society. I was just there. I left Iran. I stopped in Turkey. Every time I'm within 1,000 miles of Turkey, I want to go stop there again. I don't see it as Islamization. I see it as something else. You do see more public signs of religiosity, and secularists do not monopolize the public discourse like they used to. But this is a result of democracy. You know, for many decades, Turks had a kind of limited democracy, and they were required to say they believed certain things. Like they believed religion was bad for society, and they believed that secularism was the most important quality in life. Actually, many Turks never believed that. What's happened in the last decade or two is that the lid has been taken off. Turks don't have to repeat anything by rote anymore. They can say what they really believe. And what happened was a lot of Turks never really did assimilate that extreme secularism. So now what you're seeing, I think, is the result of democracy. And that's really not a result of Islamist politics, but it's the end of Islamist politics, because since the Turkish political system is open enough to absorb people who are conservative believers, you don't have to have a separate kind of society or a separate kind of politics for Islamists like you have to do in Egypt or some other countries. The system is able to bring these people in, and that's one of the great stabilizing factors in Turkey.
My guest is Stephen Kinzer, who served as the New York Times bureau chief in Turkey, Germany, and Nicaragua, and as the Boston Globe's Latin American correspondent, the author of a number of books, including Overthrow, All the Shah's Men, Crescent and Star, and now Reset, Iran, Turkey, and America's Future. It's published by Times Books. We'll continue our conversation after this. We're back with Stephen Kinzer, whose latest book is Reset, Iran, Turkey, and America's Future. It's published by Times Books. How do European attitudes towards Muslims affect the attitudes of people in Turkey? For example, the growing popularity of the anti-immigrant, anti-Muslim Freedom Party in the Netherlands, and we've seen similar situations in France, in Germany, and elsewhere throughout Europe.
This is a very important factor in trying to explain what's been happening in these recent weeks in Turkey. Don't forget that Turkey, at the beginning of this decade, was working very intently to get into the European Union. But the European Union has made clear that Turkey's not getting in, at least not anytime soon.
But weren't there also people in Turkey who were trying to sabotage that effort?
Absolutely. There are people there who like the cozy economic non-transparency, and they like the political power that the military has and that other institutions have that can't continue if they're an EU member.
And then Greece is an EU member, and that has to be a problem for them.
Although the Greeks, interestingly enough, along with the Italians and the Spanish, are promoting Turkish entry because they'd like to see the center of gravity of the EU move toward the south. Now, had the European Union not behaved this way, would the situation now have been different? I think maybe it would have been. I understand Europe's reluctance. They've got a lot of their own reasons, and Europe is having a huge identity crisis now anyway and maybe not ready to take on another big country like Turkey. Nonetheless, if Turkey had been encouraged or embraced by the EU, would they now be doing what they're doing? I think maybe not. I think maybe they would have devoted their geopolitical energy more to anchoring themselves in the European project.
Well, if Turkey and Israel had good relations until fairly recently, why have we seen this change, this turn of events? Was this something that was that horrified the Turkish government?
I think the real spark for this latest round and this trouble between Turkey and Israel was Gaza. Don't forget,
but Gaza's been a problem, a hotspot for a long, long time.
But it's only been the last couple of years since the Israeli occupation began that the Turks focused on it, and I think without that, you'd still have a much warmer relationship between Israel and Turkey. Now, I do blame the Turks for having been too confrontational. You know, their whole attitude is, let's resolve problems by negotiation, by conciliation. And here's a case where I think you could say to them, wait a minute, you didn't follow your own rules in this one.
But they don't always follow their own rules. They have a Kurdish problem as well.
That would be the number one thing Turkey needs to do in order to increase its credibility as a believer in conciliation. That would be the first answer that any country like the U.S., for example, that doesn't like this new conciliatory approach of Turkey, to say to Turkey, oh, you want to solve all problems by conciliation? Why don't you start at home with the Kurds? And I think that's something the Turks really have to address if they want to be taken seriously as a promoter of diplomatic solutions.
How does the American presence in Iraq affect the Kurdish situation in Turkey?
The Kurds of northern Iraq and the Kurds of Turkey are hugely pro-American. They're the only group other than Iranians that really love America. I think it's not so much the presence of American troops in Iraq, but the entire U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq over these last 6 or 7 years that has really had an effect on Turkish public opinion. an unstable neighborhood. Upheaval and turmoil and murder in a country that borders on you is always bad. It has been terrible for Turkey's economy. It's been terrible for Turkey's place in the world. And the Iraq adventure, I think, probably didn't turn a lot of Turks against America, but in the long run, it gave them a reason to be very skeptical about U.S. plans in the Middle East.
They must also be upset every time Congress, I think reasonably, votes to recognize the fact that there was an Armenian genocide.
That's certainly an issue.
And why do they keep on denying what seems to be a fact of history?
Well, that's a very good question. There are some reasons why they continue to deny this fact of history. Part of it is that they never learned this in school. Everything that they learned told them that Armenian claims are a lie. That's starting to change in Turkey. There's been dramatic change in the last 10 years in Turkey's willingness to confront this. Another problem is that Turks are almost all coming from families that are victims themselves of ethnic cleansing. They came from the Balkans or Greece or Arabia or the Caucasus after Muslims lost wars in the 19th century. So they see themselves as victims of ethnic cleansing, and it's quite horrifying for them to be accused of being perpetrators of it. Nonetheless, you're absolutely right. This is something Turkey needs to get right. The Turkish general official view of what happened in 1915 is not correct.
Do they not recognize that they had an Ottoman Empire and probably created enemies all throughout the Middle East? How are they viewed today by the rest of the Muslim world?
Well, actually, I think Turkey is in is ascendant in the Muslim world. And I tell you why. First of all, I think although the Ottoman Empire in some areas ended badly, as time passes, there's some positive memories about the fact that it was a multicultural, relatively tolerant empire.
There were no borders.
People could keep their own religions, their own local forms of government. Second reason why I think Turkey is very attractive is that it's a great model for other Islamic countries. Turkey has a free society and a booming economy. It's the kind of country that any Muslim or anyone would like to live in. But there was always one drag on Turkey's ability to influence the Muslim world, and it was Turkey's militant secularism. Many Muslims came to the conclusion Turkey's not even really a Muslim country anymore. They're all atheists over there. Now, the Turkish leader prays every day, and he's got a wife that wears a headscarf. This has tremendously increased Turkey's ability to project its influence throughout the Islamic world.
How is what kind of relations does it have with Iran? After all, Turkey is still a Sunni nation, and Iran is the largest Shiite nation.
But they have something very important in common, which is that not only are they big powers and economic as well as political powers, but they are the two major non-Arab civilizations in the Muslim Middle East. And they both share, how could I put it in a delicate way, sort of a limited love for Arabs, let's put it that way. And I think both of them see the Arab world as being really stuck. The Arab world is in a very bad place. It's the only part of the world that the democratic revolution has totally bypassed. And Arab societies are decomposing. Had Iraq been stronger, or even Pakistan or Egypt, those countries could have emerged as leaders. But their societies are in such bad shape, it leaves a vacuum for Turkey.
My guest is Stephen Kinzer, whose book, Reset Iran, Turkey, and America's Future, is published by Times Books. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So the United States repairs its relations with Turkey and makes some kind of accommodation with Iran, and we have this new situation, a brave new world. Then what happens?
What I'd like to see as the outcome of all of this is a new security architecture in the Middle East. We have to pull countries out of their isolation and ask them what they need to feel safe. Like, the world needs a big security concession from Iran right now. The world also needs security concessions from Israel. But countries only make those kind of concessions when they feel safe. So the goal of our long-term policy in the Middle East ought to be to try to make all countries, particularly Iran and Israel, feel that they're safe. Then you can legitimately ask them to make security compromises.
But you say that we have to change our relationship with Saudi Arabia, for example. Now, we have had a very important long-term relationship with Saudi Arabia, based on oil, obviously. But it generally has worked, hasn't it?
The Saudis provided a lot of help for the United States during the Cold War in covert ways, some of which I discuss in my book. The Israelis did the same thing.
Then after the invasion of Kuwait, the Saudis allowed the U.S. military to stay there, which caused them all sorts of trouble. Osama bin Laden is still annoyed about that.
It might have been better looking back if they hadn't been so eager to help us. Maybe it would have been better for everybody if they'd done what Turkey did when we asked them to allow us to invade Iraq through Turkey. They said no. They were hoping they could stop the whole project that way. With Saudi Arabia and also with other Arab countries, I think our problem is that we've become too involved. We not only have a position on every argument between Arab countries, we even have positions on arguments inside Arab countries. What factions should be allowed into the government? Which should be marginalized? We're too much on top of Arab governments. We need to let Arabia be Arabia. The Americans have traditionally been very afraid of democracy in Arab countries because they're afraid that it will produce some kind of a Islamic alternative. I think that fear is correct. But actually, it's okay because these societies need to work through these options, and marginalizing people with religious beliefs is only going to make them more radical so that when they ultimately come off, the lid ultimately comes off, there'll be a more militant situation. So pulling back a little from our suffocating relationships with Arab countries like Saudi Arabia would be beneficial for both sides.
Although Saudi Arabia is the major promulgator of Wahhabism, which is fundamentalist Islam, and I'm still a little confused about how we take Iran and Turkey, two non-Arab countries, develop better relations with them, and somehow resolve problems that we have with in the Middle East, where every other country other than Israel is an Arab country.
There's no major security goal of the United States in the Middle East that can be reached without Iran. Whether it's a nuclear-free Middle East or a stable Iraq or an end to factional fighting in Lebanon or Israel-Palestine, Iran has to be in on the deal.
Now, but would Syria go along with that? Would Saudi Arabia go along with that?
I think Syria certainly would. Saudi Arabia is kind of a mystery. I do think the Saudis have a much more emotional connection to the Palestinian issue than the Iranians or the Turks do. If there were strong Arab societies that could take over a leadership position, then I don't think Turkey or Iran would be in this role. But the fact is there aren't. And I think even the Arab countries realize that. And they like the idea that particularly Turkey, maybe to a lesser extent Iran, are emerging as countries that can throw their weight around and show that a Muslim country in the Middle East can play a role in the world.
Why aren't they role models for a country like Saudi Arabia? There's a lot of innovation in Iran and a great film culture, for example, Turkey as well. Israel produces more innovation than all of those countries combined. And yet Saudi Arabia, with all of its riches, doesn't seem to be doing anything.
Saudi Arabia is a very bizarre country. I was there when I was doing research for this book. Hypocrisy is essentially the central fact of life. It's the foundation of Saudi society. The Saudi regime is essentially built on two major pillars. One is relations with the United States, and the other is the clergy of Wahhabi Islam. These are totally conflicting pillars. The clergy of Wahhabi Islam, with hundreds of millions of dollars from the Saudi government, has spent years going all over the Islamic world, building up mosques and religious schools where poor lost boys learn how to chant the Quran and hate America. And we are paying for that indirectly by our relationship with Saudi Arabia. So the conflict between these two allies of the Saudi regime, the United States and the Wahhabi clergy, had to produce some kind of a terrible clash. And that's exactly what happened on September 11th, when most of the hijackers turned out to be Saudis.
Do you think that it's useful to promote further negotiations between Israel and the Palestinians in the current political climate?
No. I don't believe negotiation is going to bring us anywhere.
We've had negotiations in the past, and they looked hopeful, and then somebody sabotaged it.
I think negotiations have really become the enemy of peace in the Middle East. The Middle East, or the Israeli-Palestine conflict, is a very odd one in the sense that everybody really knows what the end is going to be. We know what the final solution is going to be. We just can't get there. With other crises, we don't know what the end is, and that's why we're having trouble. This is such a unique one. Neither the Israeli nor Palestinian societies have the resources to make the leap toward peace, neither the emotional, political, psychological, institutional, historical resources to do that. It's only going to be by a concerted effort from outside to tell people, you know what the final solution is going to be. And this will give then leaders perhaps in Israel and the Palestinian Authority the chance to say, I hate what we have to do, but the world and the Americans are making us do it.
But aren't there just so many hurdles that have to be overcome?
Yes, but here's what I see as the biggest hurdle from the American standpoint, and that is that our foreign policy is caught in the past. We haven't adjusted it in 20 years since the end of the Cold War toward the Middle East. We are caught in the same old paradigms. What we really need to do is break out of that and try to imagine a new Middle East for the 21st century. Our foreign policy establishment is very bad at this, at reconceiving big ideas. I can accept that there might be some flaws in the ideas that I lay out in my book, Reset, but what I would insist on is we've got to have big ideas. We have to have new thinking for the Middle East because, as Einstein famously put it, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results. That's what we're doing in the Middle East.
Stephen Kinzer's latest book is called Reset, Iran, Turkey, and America's Future. It's published by Times Books. I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Always great to be with you, Leonard.